Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and my guest today is Joshua Frank of Counterpunch. And Joshua is going to talk about the presidential transition. So, Josh, this is unlike anything anybody's ever seen before. What do you think of the whole process?
Well, it's certainly not the normal process that we're used to seeing during a presidential transition. The Biden administration, or the forthcoming Biden administration, is not getting much of a handout from the Trump administration, which is continuing to go about the belief that, or the argument that this election was fraudulent and that it was stolen. And of course, we're all familiar with the lawsuits that have been filed on behalf of the Trump administration that have been completely embarrassment to anybody that's been watching. They've lost across the board, but he continues to go out there and pretend that they've won this election. And there's lots of reasons why he's doing that. But in the meantime, they're making it really, really hard for the Biden administration to get information, to have access to, the normal transition that presidential teams have. As far as from a presidential standpoint, an administrative standpoint, Biden and his team are very well versed in how all these agents function. So I don't think there's going to be quite as much of a hiccup as a lot of people are anticipating. They're putting people in place, for better or for worse, they're putting people in place that know what they're doing. But meanwhile, Trump's still out there, saying that he's won, and there's a good chance he won't be there on Inauguration Day. And there's, I saw a poll yesterday of something crazy, like 80% of Trump supporters believe this election was fraudulent. So mm-hmm. What this means, going forward for, as frail as our democracy is, moving forward, what this means is going to be pretty interesting. I think that our the faith in the election system is starting to dwindle, and the damage might be irreparable for quite some time. The Republican Party is going to have a real mess on their hands from trying to corral the disenfranchised Republicans out there. But a lot of this is just for show as well. The Republicans really need to hold on to the Senate. And the runoffs in Georgia are a large part of why they're continuing to play this card that the election was fraudulent. They need turnout to be really high in Georgia. If the Democrats are able to take Georgia, that's going to really hamper the Republican agenda. And frankly, Trump doesn't want to see that happen because the Democrats will begin to undo some of the more damaging Trump policies. This isn't to say that we're about to see a progressive in the White House or progressive policies coming out of the Democratic Party, but we're certainly going to see a shift away from the Republicanism under Trump. That's a long answer to your question, but it is unlike anything we've ever seen, and I think the divide in this country is unlike anything that we've really experienced in recent memory. And it's been exacerbated, of course, by COVID, by the economy, and then by an unhinged president in the White House that has a Twitter account.
One of my guests on this show once said that if it wasn't for COVID, Trump would have won hands down. Do you think that's the case?
It's hard to say if he would have won hands down. I do think even before COVID, you really saw a lot of opposition to Trump, Republicanism. I think that there were other factors that played into it. I think the Supreme Court galvanized Democratic voters. I think Trump's assault on science, climate change also did that. And, I think also over the past 4 years, despite the fact that the stock market was doing exceptionally well, the day-to-day life for so many Americans was not good. Even before the pandemic, workers were paycheck to paycheck. So many families barely could make do, you know, the rent on time. And jobs in this country, as we know, you know, you can work full time and still be at the poverty level. Mm-hmm. Companies don't pay enough. You know, there's so many factors that I think got worse under the Trump administration that certainly predated him. But I do think that in large part, aside from COVID, I think COVID has been, it's exposed a lot of these things, but these fissures in our society were present even before COVID. So COVID definitely put a spotlight on it, but I think a lot of these things that were happening that people like Bernie Sanders and others were talking about way before the pandemic were very real all the way through. And so, yeah, I don't know if Trump would have won hands down. In fact, I think there's an argument to be made that the pandemic, a large part of the Republican voters have, you know, don't believe the pandemic is real. They don't believe that it's as serious as it is. And they believe, you know, a mask mandate is a threat to their personal freedoms. And of course, we've seen the disastrous results of, you know, state governments that have not instituted restrictions. But, you know, regardless, despite the fact that there's, you know, yesterday we had over 3,000 deaths in this country, despite the astronomical numbers, you know, you still have a lot of people that are not taking this serious. You know, they're going to get together. And the Trump administration, of course, is not talking about it either. You know, I think from day one, had Trump said, hey, let's all come together as a nation to beat this back. Let's all wear a mask and social distance, the outcome would have been much, much, much different. But instead, we had the complete opposite, and we've seen the sad reality from that tactic.
Yesterday, there were as many deaths as there was on 9/11. That's a pretty sobering number, don't you think?
It certainly should be. I mean, and if you look at the weekly totals, I mean, it's just, it's beyond anything that we've ever experienced. And, you know, I've known a number of people that have had COVID. One of my good friends is an emergency room nurse in Portland, Oregon, and he got COVID from a mm-hmm. patient. You know, the healthcare workers are just stretched so thin, and there's virtually no state that isn't being impacted by this. You know, the ICU beds in every state are nearly at capacity. If not, they're going to be very soon. It's a horrible situation, and our healthcare workers, the frontline workers, are the ones that are paying the price for the negligence of this administration and so many selfish people out there.
So you raised an interesting before. You used the words this election galvanized Democratic voters. And I find that very interesting because Biden is to the right of center. And the people like AOC, Bernie Sanders, they're kind of like leaning towards the left of center. So Howie Hawkins said that Democratic voters just wanted to get Trump out of there. They didn't care who ran on the Democratic ticket. It was just, we got to get Trump out. And they made no demands on him. Therefore, Trump owes the progressives nothing. What do you think?
Oh, Biden does not owe the progressives anything. I think that, you know, in large part, the progressives and the people that would consider them left of center that supported Biden, that have more progressive policy outlooks than Biden, nonetheless supported him because of, you know, the alternative was so bad with Trump. Not putting any pressure on the Biden campaign. We're starting to see the ramifications of that now with a lot of these appointments, you know, to across the board, aside from maybe an argument with Janet Yellen with Treasury. But, you know, you've got you have the left wing of the Democratic Party, if you want to call it left wing, the Bernie Sanders wing, you know, of the Democratic Party that has been given nothing, despite the fact that during the primaries, the biggest challenge to the centrist Democratic politics was the Sanders movement, was the young progressive people. They fell short, of course, but it still was a large portion of the primary voters in the Democratic Party. Those young people largely, and others as well, of course, and a lot of minorities and others that supported the Sanders campaign, the Latinx folks out in near where I live, of course, largely supported Sanders. The Democratic Party has already turned their back on these people because they can take their votes for granted, which the Democratic Party has done for forever. You can go back to the Carter administration. You can. And even look at Ralph Nader's candidacy in 2000 and the pressure that put on, you know, the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, instead of embracing the progressive movement in this country, has turned their backs on it. And, of course, you've seen that come to fruition now with the way that they treat AOC and the squad, the way that they have demonized Bernie Sanders. And yet Bernie still comes back to the fold and is out there campaigning for Biden. You know, I think in the end, that's just a pretty poor example for progressive politics in this country. As much as I respect Bernie Sanders and so much of what he's been able to accomplish, I think he's fallen short because time and time again, being ostracized by the Democratic establishment and him continuing to come back instead of saying, hey, look, we need a third party in this country. We need a progressive party. The Democratic Party isn't for us. Let's come together and you know, build a third party or join the Green Party or you know, whatever. He failed to do that, and Bernie is never going to do that because in the end, Bernie is more of an establishment guy than he is a radical, and you know, that's what we're at. But with that said, that movement, the Bernie movement. I do have some hope that a lot of these people that supported Bernie Sanders, especially the young people that this might have been their first sort of foray into electoral politics and the excitement that they saw around that, you know, candidacy, and now seeing how the Democratic Party is treating them, maybe they will break away, you know. I mean, think of how amazing it would be if AOC came out tomorrow and said, the Democratic Party is a party of corporatists, it's a party of the fossil fuel industry, it's a party of private healthcare industry. I don't want to be a part of that party any longer. That's right. Yeah. And think if you were to do that, and it would send shockwaves through Washington, and it would probably be the most, you know, radical political thing that's happened in Washington in years, and it could potentially be a game changer. I don't think that she's going to do that, but it would be that big of a moment, and it would be one that could radically change the politics of this country forever. And I have a lot of criticisms of, you know, the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, but, you know, they are a very active, lively, a bunch of people that are pushing for radical change, and they're definitely not afraid of taking on the corporate Democrats. And I think there's a lot of them that would follow the lead of someone like AOC if she were to leave the Democratic Party. But again, I don't think that's going to be happening
anytime soon.
Right? not anytime soon, but you know, she's, as she gets, And I'm not just putting this all on AOC. There's a number of congressional Democrats that are, you know, anti-establishment Democrats out there. And I think that there's a lot of responsibility with the squad. And But with that said, you know, if they were to break away from the Democratic Party, it would be a real game changer. And the more they're disenfranchised and the more that they're, you know, swept under the rug and ignored, the louder our voices will become. And I think that's what we're going to see moving forward. I mean, conditions in this country aren't going to get better under a Biden administration. You know, there might be some relief, some, you know, polishing around the edges, but the fundamental stratification, economic, social, environmental in this country are going to continue, you know, no matter who is in the White House right now. So, you know, that's the makings of a revolution, in my view, that over time, the more people that are disenfranchised, the more people that are, you know, on the edges of society, the better the chances for an actual, you know, structured revolt.
There were a number of people who were dissatisfied and disenchanted with Obama. Why didn't they learn any lessons? Why didn't they learn anything and realize that Biden is cut from the same cloth?
You know, I think a lot of people did realize that Biden is from the same cloth. You know, even so, Obama still remains one of the most popular presidents in history. And largely it wasn't because of his policies. It was because of who he was and who he pretended to be in some ways. And he continues to be, you know, how many people that even criticized Obama during the administration were 2 years into the Trump administration talking about how much they missed Obama. It's easy, you know, in retrospect to look at his record and polish it and, you know, champion him as being the first black president. You know, those kind of things do matter. However, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, Obama was right of center and, you know, Biden, of course, is cut from the same cloth, like you said. And so what we can expect is more of those sort of corporate friendly policies. But, you know, I think it's hard in this sort of day and age when we've been living under the constant psychological barrage of Twitter madness from Trump to, you know, I think there's even a lot of people out there, a lot of people that I know personally that are progressives that have been so upset day in and day out because of the madness of the Trump regime that they'd more than willing go back to the Obama years where at least they knew what they were dealing with. So, you know, I think in that sense, some people, right or wrong, believe that with the Biden administration, at least they'll have some semblance of normalcy, channels of communication with certain agencies, the ability to hopefully push him to the left. Again, how does that happen in lieu of having a radical grassroots social or environmental movement? Or, you know, I have some hope, you know, that the Black Lives Matter movement is going to continue to put pressure on a Biden administration for the reforms that they're calling for. So there is some things that have come out of this these dark Trump years that potentially could, you know, impact the future of the next 10, you know, 8 to 10 years, depending on what happens. But, you know, I think that there is some light on the horizon as far as that goes. And I think, you know, Black Lives Matter, you know, that came, you know, I think the Occupy Wall Street, the aftermath of that is still present. And I think it will go forward as that power continues to be consolidated.
I remember seeing Howard Stern on with Anderson Cooper one day, and Howard Stern was saying that Donald Trump ran for the presidency as a publicity stunt. Okay, if he did that and it gained traction, if the Democrats had picked a more credible candidate than Hillary Clinton. I don't think Trump would ever have won. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's easy to forget about the 2016 election, isn't it? That there was, to both candidates, Hillary and Trump were the most unliked, unpopular candidates ever in the history of a presidential election since they started doing polling on those things. More people voted against Hillary than for Hillary. More people voted against Trump than for Trump. It was a real mess. And I do think that had the Democrats nominated a candidate that was more, even more likable, not necessarily even different politics, I think Trump had a good shot of losing. But I also think that a lot of people, even in this last election, really, really underestimated the type of support that Trump was able to get among working class white voters and among others. Trump, I think, was greatly underestimated, as the polls showed time and time again. They were all wrong. And even this time around, largely, they were wrong again. Of course, Biden was able to win. But I think there was the resentment in this country is so great. And I think that Trump was able to really tap into that fear, into that divisiveness, into that division that he is so good at. I think that still would have been a very close election. But Hillary still won the popular vote by millions of votes, right? So it's not like this country is that's a complete another problem, of course, that we don't actually live in a true democracy. But Hillary still won, and Biden won by even more.
So you write for, or you're an editor, I'm sorry, for Count the Punch online magazine. Give yourself a plug. Tell everybody about your magazine, what you do, and what message you're trying to bring forth.
Counterpunch has been around for over 25 years. It was founded by investigative journalist Ken Silverstein. And soon after he started Counterpunch, Alexander Coburn, whose name might be familiar with a lot of your listeners, came on board. Alex passed away maybe 8 years ago now. I came on as an editor after Alex passed away at that time, but I have been writing for Counterpunch for over 15 years now. Jeffrey St. Clair was an early editor that's been around, and he still is our editor. If you go to Counterpunch, we update the website at counterpunch.org. We've updated 5 days a week. Lots of great material. You can find culture, movie reviews, all the way to, you know, politics, of course. And we run the gamut. I mean, we are the place to go for discourse on the left. You're guaranteed to be upset, and you're guaranteed to find something that you don't agree with, but you'll also find things you do agree with. But that's what makes, I think, Counterpunch so intellectually stimulating, is that we are a boxing ring of debate, and we punch it out, and that's what we do. And we publish books, we have a podcast, I think it's a great place for everybody to come and check out, especially if you want to make sense of the world that we're living in. We don't cater to political parties, and we hold everybody's feet to the fire. So I think the readers that are out there that know what Counterpunch is will testify to that.
You were living in New York for a while. You were living in the Albany area. How'd you wind up at Counterpunch?
I started writing for Counterpunch before I lived in New York. Jeffrey St. Clair and I teamed up and written a lot of stuff together. We most recently published a book of our essays called The Big Heat. So Jeff and I had worked together a lot, and I had lived in Oregon where Jeff is before I moved to New York. And then I moved back to Oregon at that time, and thus we continued working together and writing together. And so it kind of just developed a working relationship, and then it transpired from there.
So did you like your time in New York?
I love New York. You know, I think I love the Albany area. I think it's a great community. It's diverse. I like the activism there. I think a lot of the left politics in the New York area are old school left wing, and I think there's a lot that could be learned from where I live out here on the West Coast as far as organizing goes. And the people have been at it a long time out there. I grew up in Montana, and there was a lot of similarities as far as community goes and connection to the food culture, to where your food is grown. There's a big local movement in upstate New York that I think is part of the culture. It's ingrained in the culture, and I think that is something I really miss. It's harder to find that in the same way on the West Coast, outside of maybe parts of the Bay Area and parts of Oregon, of course. But in Southern California, where I live, that's harder to find. We have great farmers markets and, of course, the fantastic produce, but the culture itself, it's just harder to come by. It seems more ingrained in upstate New York.
So
I don't necessarily miss the 2 feet of snow, though.
Oh, that's the fun part. So
yeah,
if anybody wants to read Counter Punch, tell people how they can do it, and tell people how they can reach you on social media.
Sure. Counterpunch is on social media, of course. If you just go to Twitter or Facebook and type in Counterpunch, you can find our social media profiles and articles that we share. And then you can also just open your web browser and type in counterpunch.org. And we'll provide you with advertisement-free reading. It's one of the cool things about Counterpunch is we don't run ads. We're completely funded by our readers, small donations. So come on by and check us out. And if you like us, sign up for our little newsletter that we send out 5 days a week as well. So you don't have to be reminded to, you know, we'll drop an email in your inbox and you can find the articles that you want to read through the emails as well. And love to have you come on board.
Thank you so much, Jess. I look forward to speaking with you again. You've been listening to Joshua Frank of Counterpunch. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed. And if you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thanks, Josh. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.